Thank you for joining us today for Oklahoma Voices. I'm Jacob McClellan. The Oklahoma legislature wrapped up its session on May the 22nd, 1 week ahead of schedule. The body passed a budget that cut funding for many agencies while using rainy day and revolving funds to shore up a $611 million shortfall. They also approved bonds for a pop culture museum in Tulsa and the American Indian Cultural Center and Museum in Oklahoma City. But how will the legislature address next year's budget? I'm joined now by Adam Brooks. He's the managing editor of the Journal Record newspaper. We also have Dale Denwall, who covers the legislature for the Journal Record, and M. Scott Carter. He's a political reporter at Oklahoma Watch. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today on Oklahoma Voices.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about the budget first. This is a $7.1 billion budget. It's a little bit smaller than the current fiscal year. Scott, who are the big winners and losers in this year's budget?
Well, I think this year's budget is primarily composed of losers. I don't see a whole lot of winners in it. There were a few agencies that got little bumps, corrections, health department, mental health, the healthcare authority. But most agencies saw cuts or standstill budgets. Common Ed, the biggest being, got a standstill budget. And then higher ed effectively took a 2.44% cut, and Career Tech took a 3.5% cut. So there weren't too many winners out of the budget deal. They had that $611 million budget hole, and they spent a lot of time trying to fix that before they could address any growing needs. So I don't know whether I would say there were too many winners at all.
And Dale, was there anybody that you saw in this budget really come hard off on this one?
I think Scott makes a good point in that there weren't a lot of winners out there. The way that the legislature claimed victory in saying that we didn't cut the budget so much, we kept a lot of people flat, we gave increases to people, the cuts weren't that small. That was earned by dipping into revolving funds that these agencies hold, these savings accounts.
And before the session, the governor had talked a lot about that part of the problem with the budget in the state was that so much of this money was not touchable by the legislature, that the money was there, but it was held up in revolving funds, it was held up in other ways, it was appropriated off the top. And she talked about changing that process, but I'm not sure that much got done about that during the session.
Well, that's a really interesting point, too, that there was that $611 million shortfall. It used a lot of one-time monies for this. I mean, for next year, for the next fiscal year, does the legislature have any ideas to help shore this up and work toward having a more sustainable budget in the future?
Well, they're going to go back to the same sources. They'll go back to the rainy day fund if they need to, because there's still about $350 million left in it. They'll go back to the cash reserve fund. And a lot of people, that blows past a lot of people. When you have to keep in mind that the legislature only appropriates 95% of the tax revenue that comes in, and 5% is set aside. That's that cash flow reserve fund. They took $120 million out of that this year. Expect them to do that again next year. They also took $50 million out of unclaimed property this year. They'll probably go back to unclaimed property again next year. What makes matters worse next year, though, is there's a income tax cut that's getting ready to kick in that's going to take, when you amortize it out over the year, it's going to pull about another $100 million out of the budget. So they're going to be looking at this same issue again, where to cut spending. And it's not going to be where do we take revenue and place it for priorities as much as it's going to be who do we cut to make sure the budget's balanced.
And while oil prices have stopped falling, we don't know that they're really going to bounce back. So we don't know when drilling will pick up again and when that tax money will start coming back into the pot.
There are a lot of crossed fingers at the legislature hoping that the revenue is going to come back. They have done some things to make sure that these off-the-top funds won't be such a hit in the future, and making sure that they review these tax incentives, which we'll get to later, to make sure that in the future the amount of money that the state has is going to be a little bit larger. But for next year and maybe the year after that, I'm not sure that they're quite there yet.
Now, Scott, you had mentioned that Corrections was one of the few agencies that actually saw a funding increase in this session. But this is a system that's overcrowded and understaffed. I mean, was there anything else in this session in particular that's going to help ease those issues in the Corrections Department?
Yeah, Corrections got $14 million extra, and there were several bills done. If you go back and remember, if you go back a couple of years, I think it was either last year or the year before, DOC Director Patton pulled all the prisoners out of county jails, took them into state custody. County sheriffs and county commissioners are really upset by this because counties contract with the state to hold prisoners, and the state pays them a per diem for each head that's in that county facility. When they pulled all that out, it saved the state money, but it took a lot of money out of county budgets. This year, they passed a bill that they worked with the sheriff's departments on and the sheriff's association and county officials and corrections officials that said when the state is at capacity, that before they go to a private prison, county officials have the right of first refusal. They have to ask them, can you hold prisoners? So it's a way to redirect some of that money back. We saw things like that. We also saw a little bit them kind of dabbling around the edges on corrections reform. There's a bill that gives judges a little more flexibility in sentencing inmates who are convicted of drug crimes, which is about 70% of the state's prison population. And another bill that gave judges more flexibility on mandatory minimum sentences. Doing that, which is exactly the opposite of legislation that was passed about a decade and a half ago, doing that, you could see in the next few years fewer inmates being sentenced to long sentences and more being redirected into treatment and work release and things like that. I think those things are the beginnings of a little bit of judicial reform effort, but the legislature is facing a time clock on that. Literally, Ryan Kiesel, the head of the ACLU, said it years ago. Hickman has said it. He said it this year. We are one lawsuit away from federal control of the state's corrections department. And if they don't get reform issues done quick enough before that, you'll see the feds come in.
With the mandatory minimum sentencing, how is this going to affect the prison population long term? As I understand it, the impacts will be pretty small to begin with because it's not retroactive. But in the long term, years in the future, how will this help?
Well, instead of sending a guy who's sentencing a guy to life in prison for drug-related crimes, you sentence him to 20 years or less. He gets out in 6 or 10 on good behavior, and part of that is a probation sentence that requires drug treatment. It takes a lot of strain off the system. You don't have to pay all that money longer on to keep those guys incarcerated.
Yeah, I think nationally and in Oklahoma, there's on both sides of the political spectrum, there's kind of this movement to look at why we're locking people up and whether that's the best way to handle them in terms of keeping people safe and in terms of spending our money. You know, we saw in Nebraska this year that they got rid of the death penalty, a very conservative state, but they realized it was costing too much and wasn't very effective. So I think a lot of places are looking at ways to do prison smarter. You still want public safety, but maybe you don't have to spend as much money locking up a huge percentage of the population.
And then you have the chairman of the Senate Appropriation Committee saying that we need a prison right now, and he's not sure if it's going to be an existing prison that's out there that needs to be converted from, say, a private prison to a public prison, or if they need to build a prison, or if they need to find a facility that can hold a couple of thousands of people that is already built. But the issue remains that we still don't have enough room to hold everyone we have.
Changing the topic a little bit, we've had a really soggy May, lots of rain, flooding throughout the states. There are a bunch of roads that have been underwater, lots of damage.
Railroads too.
Where will the funds come from to repair a lot of these infrastructure problems that we're experiencing right now, Dale?
Well, I know that there is a revolving fund for emergencies that counties can use, and there's about $15 million in it of credit at any one time. The problem is when these rains started, about $12 million of that was already taken out for other projects that counties wanted. So that leaves about $3.5 million, and it's a process that takes about a month usually, or a month and a half, to actually get that money. But it's a loan. You have to pay it back.
You'll also see, I think the governor's already done this. She's directed the Oklahoma Department of Transportation to help out. They'll redirect some resources, especially on roads and bridges that provide major access for rural areas back into metro areas. You saw that with the bridge over by Purcell. You'll see some more of that. But, yeah, there's... The rains came at a bad time at the same time the legislature was tapping the County Road and Bridge Improvement Fund. So there's going to be some problems for the long term.
Is that going to hurt the governor's long-term goal of getting our bridges and roads structurally sufficient?
Well, yes, I think so. I think it will for a while, because it wasn't just, you know, as everyone knows, it was a pretty substantial amount of rain. What is it, the most the Oklahoma's ever received in May,
yeah.
Like record setting?
Yep.
So there's a lot of these structures that really took it on the chin. Plus the House Democrats this year, I believe they held a press conference out by the Bell Isle overpass, and if you looked at the photographs they released of that. That overpass, I don't even want to drive on it anymore. It looks pretty frightening.
A lot of exposed rebar.
Right. Transportation infrastructure has been an issue for years. They had been allocating money and doing everything they could to catch up. I know at one time there were thousands of thoroughfares and bridges that were on the list. They've reduced that down to several hundred. But they still got a long way to go, Adam, and I think you make a good point that it could hamper the governor's efforts to get all those done before she leaves office. I don't see that happening. It may take a couple of more governors before that's finally complete.
Yep. So, Scott, have there been any changes in how agencies can access revolving funds?
Yeah, this year they did something. Earl Sears told me, Earl Sears is the chairman of the House Budget Committee, and he told me they did something this year and last year that they haven't done before. They gave agencies the authority to tap their own revolving fund. Now, usually the legislature comes in, they take money out of a revolving fund, gets thrown into the general appropriation pot, and then redistributed to wherever. This year, they allowed some agencies to use their own revolving fund for ongoing purposes. Sears says it was easier, it kind of cut out the middleman, and it was just easier to let agencies use those monies for themselves. Good example of that's the state Supreme Court and their technology fund. That's kind of a big change for them. It gives the agency a little more authority and a little more discretion, and it's more of a cushion because instead of wondering whether or not they're going to get all that revolving fund money back, they have it there in a little pot that they can use for resources. It puts them under more scrutiny because the guys writing the budget are going to come back in and say, okay, what did you spend this money on? And they're going to have to account for that. But it gives them more flexibility, and I contend it acts like a little bit of a cushion for them.
Adam, let's talk a little bit about how the budget came out and how it was voted on. It came out and was voted on pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Is this the process that we usually see in Oklahoma for a budget?
You know, I think there's usually a lot more open debate about it, and this seems to have been handled in the back rooms a lot before the public got a look at it, and before maybe a lot of the legislators got a look at it. The governor was a lot less visible this session than she has been in the past. She didn't have any real big issues she was focusing on, not as much controversy. So I think that she was working behind the scenes, or her people were working behind the scenes and working with Speaker Hickman and Pro Tem Bingman. And by the time this came out, it was very much pretty much set. There were a few more details, and they had to twist some arms at the end to get some votes they needed. But in large part, this seems to have been done, and I guess not an election year made a big difference in it.
Is that why you think that she was out of the spotlight so much?
It's possible. There are folks around the Capitol who have speculated that she might be wanting to make sure she doesn't do anything negative in the public light if she's looking at a Republican administration in Washington in a couple of years, and maybe there'd be a position for her there. Others think that there was no big fight and she could get most of what she wanted by staying quiet, and that was strategically the right thing to do.
Well, what do you think, Dale? Why do you think that the governor stayed out of the spotlight so much this session?
There wasn't a whole lot for her to do. The proposals that she introduced weren't very controversial. They got a lot of support from the start. And the way it was put to me is that when you don't have a lot of opposition, there's no real reason to show your face if you don't have to. And it lets the legislative guys kind of take the brunt when they need to.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, I agree some, and I disagree a little. I think the governor was very involved because the third part of that negotiation team was Preston Dorflinger, her budget secretary. And Dorflinger's really good at writing a budget. And so the governor said, here's my direction. She announced that in February during her State of the State. And I think she got a lot of what she wanted. I agree with Dale. She did introduce a whole lot that was controversial, and she put out a plan. And if you look at that plan compared to what the actual budget is, it it's pretty similar to what the governor asked for. So she didn't have to strong arm people a lot. She had Dorflinger down there doing a lot of the heavy lifting. He's really good at it. He worked really well with the House. I know there was some contention between the House and the House and the governor worked really well together, but there was some contention with the Senate. But at the end result, she got a lot of what she wanted.
Now, I think one thing she did say she wanted was to look at giving the money back to be appropriated that's already taken off the top. Did they get anything done this session that changes that situation?
The change on the county roads and bridges that put a cap on how much money flows into that fund. The Senate wanted a cap at $75 million. The House wanted the cap at $125 million. They ended up adopting the House's proposal. So, there'll be some money that flows back in from that. I don't know whether how effective they were doing that in other areas. There's good and bad to that. It, for example, the OLAP fund, the fund that funds the Oklahoma Promise Scholarship, that comes directly off the top. If you throw it back into the mix and let the legislature fight on it, then it always becomes a political football. By earmarking it ahead of time, it takes the politics out of it. So that's the good part. The bad part is you have less money to spend later on. You may see some tweaking around the edges, but I don't expect a big fundamental reform of that because it would take a lot. You go in and try to remove OLAP because it's so wildly popular or some other project like that, transportation, for example. You go in and try to remove that, and it's going to cause a firestorm. Yeah.
And there was some other talk about doing things like a big idea, like switching to one budget session one year and then a session for another issue. And it seems like those ideas were tossed around for a little bit and then sort of swept aside.
And I think you're likely to see, and Dale may disagree with me, I think you're likely to see that happen before you see a bunch of big changes on how much is removed from caps and stuff like that.
Yeah, talking to the Speaker of the House, he didn't give a whole lot of water to that idea. And I'm not sure why, but I think probably it has to do with there are policy issues facing the legislature every year, and there are budget issues facing the legislature every year. And it probably depends on who's the speaker, who's the pro tem, and who's the governor, if they can wrangle everyone together and get through a session without too much trouble.
It did seem like the speaker this year kind of kept everything focused on these fiscal issues and a few policy issues and not as much what are usually called social issues. You know, some of the more controversial Sally Kern bills that got talked about at the beginning of the session didn't get hearings in the full House. Is he operating differently than some of his predecessors?
I think so. You didn't see a whole lot of sort of the conscientious sort of rally the Republican base issues, except for these fiscal issues that we all know about. You didn't see a lot of the social issues get out of committee, if it even got that far.
Let's talk a little bit about the spin on the budget as far as common education, which was kept flat. But education advocates, are saying that they're quick to point out that this flat funding is really a cut due to inflation, whereas others will say, well, wait, other agencies were cut, but this one's kept flat.
And they didn't get the teacher raises.
Teachers haven't gotten raises in years. I mean, was there any good news that came out of this session for teachers?
No, not really. They didn't get the testing changes they wanted. There's still a lot of mandatory tests. The pressure's there to do something, but it didn't get done. They didn't get a pay raise yet again. And the districts that are going to see a lot of student growth and increases in the cost of healthcare and stuff like that are still going to be underfunded because there wasn't a lot of money.
And we still don't know what's going to replace Common Core.
Exactly.
Last session that got repealed, and we don't know what's going to replace it yet, and that will have to go through the legislature next session. So that'll be interesting. Yeah, I know some folks in education, and I initially thought that this idea of replacing the EOIs, the end of instruction tests, with the ACT was a bad idea. And a lot of teachers and educated administrators tell me they actually – it's not that they think the ACT is perfect, but they think it'd be better than the EOIs, and more they kind of feel like – anything we can do to get rid of the number of tests that we have to give is probably going to be good, but there wasn't anything that happened with that in this session.
It's a great example of why the legislature should really leave education policy to education experts, because they're so sensitive to political pressure, and they go in and make all these changes, and they go back in a few years later and make them again. And they really need to try to step away from some of that, because the education community and the experts in the field and the boots on the ground, the teachers in the classroom, have far more experience at that than a state lawmaker.
Whatever happened with tax incentives?
You saw them
Dale,
adopt...
I see you smiling over here, Dale.
Okay. And they did roll back the wind exemption for wind energy.
That's right. There were a couple of tax credits or tax incentives for the wind industry that if you talk to the wind folks, they say, yeah, we agreed to it. But it really is a loss for them because they can't claim the ad valorem exemption or the property tax exemption that they could in the past. And as far as tax exemptions, tax credits, tax incentives go, the legislature did make sort of a gain toward the kind of policy that was supported by State Representative David Dank, who passed away during session this year. He liked the bill. He didn't think it went far enough, but a couple of measures would provide would force the legislature to review these tax incentives, every tax incentive every few years. And also, if you create a new tax incentive, you have to provide goals that it must accomplish.
Well, one thing that bill also included that blows past a lot of people is all those incentives had a sunset date set on them. Now, as it was described to me by a lobbyist, he goes, well, all that is the Tax Incentive Lobbyist Employment Act, because once that once that incentive expiration date appears, whoever's behind that incentive is going to go hire a lobbyist to say, oh, no, we need to keep this. So that's part of the equation, too. But they did put a sunset provision, which means that this incentive will go away on a particular date, and they put that on all those incentives. It remains to be seen whether or not any of those will actually go away on the dates.
Was that on all new incentives, or
No, it was on the existing incentives.
Well, we're running out of time, and I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about the American Indian Cultural Center and Museum in Oklahoma City and the Tulsa Pop Cult Culture Museum. The legislature approved $25 million in bonds for both these projects. Did this come as a surprise to any of you that both of these passed?
Kind of.
Yes and no. I expected them to do something on the cultural center. It's been a albatross around their neck for several years now, and the pressure was building to get it done. The tribes really wanted to get it done, and lots of people in the business community, especially in the tourism business community, really wanted to get it done. The Pops Museum was a wild card. The sole reason that passed was the skill that Bob Blackburn used in developing a long-term business plan. And the way he lobbied lawmakers.
He's the head of the Oklahoma Historical Society, which exactly. Will run it. Yeah, there's somebody who asked me, why did they just need to give Tulsa $25 million and the American Indian Cultural Center $25 million? Shouldn't that have been easy to think? It's like, it's not really the same thing, because they've already sunk $40, $50 million into the American Indian Museum over the last 20 years. And so
like it was 80, actually.
Oh, yeah. But I think I was a little bit surprised they did get something, because Speaker Hickman before the session had said it was a priority to get something done about it. But until we saw the indications of what the bill would be with handing it back to Oklahoma City, they weren't publicly saying what the plan was. So they came up with something that seems, like it's probably affordable. And if Oklahoma City agrees to it, seems like it makes sense, and the state will get this this crown jewel attraction. But if it ever needs any more money, I don't know where it would come from.
No, there won't ever be another state appropriation to it.
Definitely not for the state.
I doubt that. I don't see that happening.
The story of the American Indian Cultural Center Museum is not over yet. If you go to the city and ask them what they think about it, they really don't have an answer for you. If you ask them what they think about the plan, they really don't have an answer for you. I think we'll see something this summer, and if I had to predict, I'd say that they'd probably go ahead with it and shuffle off management of the museum to a trust or some other private entity. But remains to be seen.
Now, I'm an Oklahoma newbie, so I have to ask, why has this project been so long delayed? What's happened here?
It was done in the 90s, and actually I think the lawmaker that authored the original bill was Senator Kelly Haney, member of the Seminole tribe, who was also a Senate appropriations chair at the time. This dates me that I know that, but that's okay. And there was a fight after they'd funded it for several years, and the agency came back and said, we need more money, and it started a fight and called for an audit and this and that. The last 3 or 4 years of this, though, I don't think it's been a fight, at least within the House, I don't think it's been a fight as much over do we need a Native American Cultural Center as it's been a fight between the Speaker of the House, Speaker Hickman, and the city of Oklahoma City. And I think the issue that was had everything to do with water, because when Jeff Hickman was a state representative, Oklahoma City went in and drained Canton Lake. And that was in his district, and he and several other lawmakers threw a fit about that, and Oklahoma City wasn't very responsive. Jeff Hickman, with regards from Oklahoma City's viewpoint, they were kind of surprised that Jeff Hickman became Speaker Hickman. And when you're the Speaker, you got a lot more clout. And then suddenly the Speaker decides the fate of the Cultural Center, and the same people that were kind of blowing him off about taking water from the lake in his district now had to come back and ask them to finish this museum in Oklahoma City. And I think there was some political tension between that, and that's why you didn't see it done up until now.
And it was pretty impressive that after last session, where there were 3 competing plans and multiple variations on that, and they just couldn't get anything done, that he finally kind of came out and had, this is the one plan, he's going to find a way to get it done, and, you know, I don't know how much muscle it took, but sort of forced it through and got the votes he needed.
Hickman's pretty pragmatic. I mean, he's very, very smart, and he can be very focused when he needs to be. You saw that this year. I think you and Dale talked about that, about how he really ran the House pretty effectively. And I think he saw this kind of hanging out there like a dark cloud, and it's going to be there until we get something done. This was the year to get it done. It wasn't an election year. And it's done. So
now it's settled.
Was there anybody that you think, Adam, had a really good legislative session? Anybody who really stood out?
You know, it seems to me that Senator David Holt is taking a lot of positions that are pretty mainstream. He's, you know, real visible on social media. And I think he's just presenting himself as a really strong, pragmatic voice that could be a leader moving forward.
What about you, Dale?
I like Senator Holt in that he's available to talk to. You can always ask him a question. And as a Capitol reporter, you always like someone who is ready to answer any question that you have. I also found a lot of respect for Representative Earl Sears. He was always willing to talk about the budget, even if he didn't have anything to say. He was always willing to sit down and tell me that, well, we're almost there. We're almost there. Not quite. We're almost there.
I would agree with Dale and Adam both. I think Holt is positioning himself for a future leadership position. Sears has always been very pragmatic about governing, and Sears is involved in a speaker's race, and it wouldn't surprise me if he became the next speaker. Another guy out there that a lot of people don't pay attention to, but really was key in this year's budget, was State Representative Dennis Casey from Morrison. Casey's a former football coach. He's a former prize-winning football coach. The guy, in the 13 years he was at Morrison, he won 11 state championships. And he understands education deeply, worked for Career Tech, worked for the Morrison School District for decades. So he brings a wealth of knowledge, and he's just really easy to work with. He's not about fighting. He's more about let's get something done that does some good. I think you will see him rise to the top this year. It was a very astute move by the Speaker to put Sears and Casey in charge of the budget for the House.
And also Stephanie Bice is trying to get people cold beer in more locations, so she's pretty popular.
Well, and Kay Floyd, too. Kay Floyd really did well, kind of thrust into the limelight as one of the minority leaders in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And she's very, very articulate, very well-spoken, and played the role of what the minority party should do, which was knowing when to lob that bomb and knowing when to say yes. And she did that very well.
Yeah, there were some funny things, bills that were proposed. I believe it was Senator Sparks this might have been Emily Virgin in the House, who wanted to allow any business that wanted to refuse gay customers, they were welcome to, but they had to post a sign that said exactly who they discriminated against.
That was done by Emily Virgin, who is just really, really smart.
Yeah.
And she's really fun to watch because she doesn't wade in on a whole lot. But when she does, she usually comes in with both barrels loaded and is really good at kind of shooting down bad ideas.
We've been talking today to M. Scott Carter. He's a political reporter for Oklahoma Watch. We also have Adam Brooks, the managing editor of the Journal Record, and Dale Denwalt. He covers the legislature for the Journal Record. Thank you so much for coming by to talk with us. It's been a pleasure talking with you guys today.
Glad to be here.
Our program was produced today by Brian Hardzinski. The views expressed in today's broadcast are not necessarily those of the staff of KGOU or its licensee, the University of Oklahoma. For more information on this and other Oklahoma Voices broadcasts, go to kgou.org. I'm Jacob McClelland. Thanks for listening this week to Oklahoma Voices.